I'm very, very pleased to be with you guys this morning. I'm kind of had some technical difficulties starting things up, so I'm running two computers at the same time, read my notes off of one and use the other one for the PowerPoint. So if I have to get caught up a little bit, just bear with me. I wanted to give you a little bit more about my background before I get started, because it really plays into the message I want to talk to you about over the next five lectures. Nice thing about having five lectures, you know, you can kind of ease into it a little bit at a time. So this will kind of be an introduction. We'll get to more of the meat of the presentations probably in the following lectures. I was probably, much like most of you guys, I grew up in a very strong Christian family. I was a covenant child. Can truly say I never knew a day that I did not know about the saving grace of Jesus Christ. I was very interested in theology from an early age. My father made me read two books before I went to college. One was called The Peter Principle, which is about the incompetence of government. He worked for the government, so he knew. The other one he made me read was Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis. So I got interested in C.S. Lewis in high school, read a lot of his stuff before that. Interestingly enough, the one thing I did not read until I got to college was the Chronicles of Narnia. I did not know about those when I was in high school. I would have read those too, I'm sure. One of the things that happened to me is I got very involved in the church. I was very involved in youth work in high school. We had a small church. I lived in rural Florida, southern rural Florida. We had a church with maybe 100 members, but yet we had about 450 members of a youth group that would meet every Sunday night that I basically helped start and run. I went on to college. I went to the University of Florida to play football, not to get a good education. I didn't get to play football. Some people didn't get a real good education. Started out as an aerospace engineer, ended up as a sociology major. There's a whole story behind that, which I won't go into. One of the things that I did while I was in college, my dad told me when I got ready to go to college, he says, you'll appreciate it more if you pay for it yourself. I thought, that's an interesting way to look at it. I paid for my sister's college, so they must not appreciate it as much as I did. But I started my first business. I'm kind of an entrepreneur. I've started a lot of businesses. I've been a turnaround guy in a number of IT businesses. Started my first business when I was in college. Into my freshman year, my dad called me. My dad had been a state worker and worked for the state, had kind of retired. Moved with his brother up to a place called Vidalia, Georgia. If you've ever seen Vidalia onions, that's where they're grown. It's in the middle of nowhere, Georgia. And they had bought a ranch and a farm and a tractor dealership and a bunch of other things. My uncle was quite an entrepreneur. And my dad called me and said, what are you doing this summer? I said, well, Dad, you know, I've got to go get a job. I'm paying for my own college, remember? And he said, yeah, he says, I remember that. He says, why don't you come up here this summer and we'll start a crop dusting business? And I had been very interested in aviation. I'd got my license when I was in high school, so I was a licensed pilot. I said, Dad, we don't know anything about crop dusting. And he said, how hard can it be? And I said, well, Dad, yeah, you got to have a crop dusting plan. I know that. He said, well, I happened to have traded a guy a crop dusting plane for a tractor, so we've got a crop dusting plane. So knowing that it's probably not work out well, I went up there. And the bad thing about crop dusting is crop dusting planes have one seat in them. So it's not like someone can take you up and show you how to do it. So we talked to some people. I got in the plane, started flying. And I had the need for speed back in those days. I raced motorcycles, I raced cars. And I'm telling you, flying in an airplane 5 feet off the ground at 130, 140 miles an hour, straight at a 100 foot pine trees at the end of a farm row, and making yourself stay down on the ground to the last minute and yank that thing straight up. Some of you have seen guys do this. It's a trip. It's like nothing else. It was very exciting. I did it for 5 years. Wrecked two airplanes. Crashed two airplanes in 5 years. I tell it's God's providence that I'm here to talk to you this morning. So feel yourself lucky. I feel like I'm lucky to be here. Went on, got out of college, and I had been real involved in church work in college as well. In fact, I got with some guys. We started a ministry. There weren't very many. Actually, the only ministry at that time at the University of Florida, this was in the last century, you realize, was a Campus Crusade. A crew had a ministry there. And they were really super nice guys, all really clean cut. I had long hair, played the guitar. Go ask your parents about Jesus freaks, and they'll tell you about Jesus. I wasn't a Jesus freak, but I hung out with a lot of Jesus freaks. Campus Crusade guys told us, if you don't cut your hair, quit singing these crazy songs, which we all sing now, you can't come worship with us. And we go, that's kind of weird. So we started our own ministry there. Anyway, by the time I got out of college, I really believe that, you know, if I want to do something significant for God, I probably need to be a pastor or a missionary. I knew God wasn't calling me to be a missionary. So I came up to Richmond, Virginia and started at Union Theological Seminary. Now, they were very liberal. I was very conservative. Probably not a good place for me. I was also a young, arrogant man at that time and argued with my professors all the time. I lasted about a year, and after about a year, I decided the one thing I'd learned is God wasn't calling me to be a pastor. So I left. I don't know who was happy to see me go, me or my professors. I think they all threw a party when I left because I asked them questions that they had a difficult time answering. And I thought, you know, if I'm here to learn, maybe this is not the right place for me. Went back to South Florida, got into the business world, and spent the next 30 years in business. Now, if you had found me about, I'd say, probably 25 years ago now, I was in Orlando, and I was running IT companies back then. This was in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s. Now, you got to realize there wasn't much of an internet back then, particularly it wouldn't be anything like you know. There wasn't even any email back in those days. This is really in the last century. This is in the dark ages of the computer world. And I ran a training company. So we trained basically network engineers. It was really cool. I remember Microsoft was one of the companies we trained for. I remember when Microsoft invented Outlook and rolled it out. So that's how long ago that was. But one of the things I began to really wrestle with in my own Christian walk was this whole idea around why did God not care about what I did from 8 to 6, 7 o'clock every day, right? Why did God not care that I ran a computer company? And I really believe he didn't. I believe he really, what was important for me was the things I did in my church and those sort of things. And it's interesting because, go the other way here. I was working in this company. I had a bunch of salespeople. Some of you may grow up to be salespeople. I hope that's true. It's a great occupation. But some of you may grow up to manage salespeople. I hope that doesn't happen. That's a terrible job, right? So I was managing all these salespeople. And you have to keep them motivated all the time. So I took them to this motivational conference. It was a motivational conference to end all motivational conferences. I mean, it was at the stadium where the Orlando Magic played. They had people like Colin Powell was there, was one of the speakers. Dick Vitale from ESPN. Some of you guys know Dick Vitale was there. And even Tony Robbins, the tall, geeky guy that you see sometimes on late-night TV. They were all there talking. And one of them came up to the microphone and said something I'll never forget. He said, if you went home tonight and found that a long-lost relative had left you $10 million, would you be at work tomorrow? A huge no rang out across the whole stadium. Everybody said that. And I can remember, don't remember anything else the guy said, because I can remember sitting there thinking, well, you know, of course I wouldn't. I would go do something important with my life, right? Because, see, I liked what I was doing, and in some sense I felt like maybe God was calling me to do it, but I saw it as merely as a means to an end, to make money, to provide for my family, put a roof over my house, you know, pay for the house, all those sort of things. I really didn't see any connection between what I did every day with what God was doing in the world. You know, I thought maybe I'd go be a pastor, go back to seminary. You know, maybe I'd redo that, right? Or maybe go be a missionary. Maybe God would use me as a missionary. Because see, at that time, I thought those were the things that were really important. Because if you'd asked me back in those days, what do you do that's important to God? This is what I would have told you. I would have said, well, I'm an elder in my church, I teach adult Sunday school, I sit on two or three non-profit boards. I never in a million years would have said, I run an IT company for the glory of God. That was not in my thinking at all. Because see, one of the problems I had back then, and what I would suggest to you this morning, is a problem that many of you have, is I had separated what God was doing from what I was doing. Okay? The more I struggled with this, the more I thought, you know, I need some advice. So where do you go? We have a spiritual problem. I went to my pastor. I said, Pastor, I'm struggling with this. And he said, well, Hugh, God's just given you the ability to make money so you can bring it to the church where you can do good things with it. I thought, no, that can't really be right. Interestingly enough, a couple of people in our church were professors at Reformed Theological Seminary, had a campus in Orlando. Interesting enough, was across the street, literally, from my computer office. And so I went and talked to a couple of them. They didn't really have any better answers either. But what they said is, Walter, you ought to come take some classes at seminary. I thought, well, I tried that once. It didn't work out too well. And they said, no, we're different. You really enjoy it. So, you know, I started praying about it and ended up going and started taking some classes at night. Literally, I could walk over after work and take a class. And I don't know, probably the first or second class I took, I started reading some stuff by guys. I have been a Presbyterian all my life, and never read anything from Francis Schaeffer. I don't know why that was true, but it was true, right? Read some stuff by Schaeffer. Read some stuff by a guy named Abraham Kuyper. Incredible guy. They led me back, interestingly enough, to the Reformers. Now, see, once I got to seminary, it didn't take but a class or two to realize they didn't have the answers to the questions I was asking either. They didn't get why my work wasn't important. In fact, they pretty much thought my work as an IT guy wasn't very important to God, right? But the more I read, the more I began to realize, and interesting stuff, the last lecture talked about how important church history was. I found the answers not in a systematic theology class, right? Not in a practical theology class, but in church history classes. And the more church history I read, the more I read about the Reformers, I began to realize this idea of integrating your faith and your work was one of the cornerstones of the Reformation. In fact, when Luther says, the work of the milkmaid is just as important to God as the work of priest, that was heresy in his day. I'm here to tell you, I speak a lot of churches, it's still heresy in a lot of churches today. Because the church in the 21st century has completely lost sight of the importance of our call to vocation. And our call to work, to put it more simply. The problem that we all have is simply this. You know, our work is important to God, and we just don't understand why that's true. We have not been taught that everything you do is to be done to the glory of God. I was on a radio show the other day and was talking about this importance. And one of the things I talked to him about was this problem that we have in the church today, that we have set up some things as secular and some things as spiritual. I would tell you this morning, and I'm going to hit back on this over and over again in my lectures, I think it's the besetting sin of the church in the 21st century that we've kind of divided our world into two worlds, part of it secular, part of it spiritual. And God only cares about the spiritual stuff, and that's what we do at church, and that's what we do at conferences like this. But when you do other things, that's not the case. I'm talking to this guy on the radio, and he goes, yeah, I get that. I said, okay. So tonight I'm going to go home and do something. I'm going to do something real spiritual for 4.5 hours. He says, what's that? I said, I'm going to watch the NCAA National Championship football game. Crickets. Nothing. And when you're talking to a radio talk show host and he's at a lack for words, you know you're in trouble, right? And it was a call-in show and there's this long kind of awkward pause because you could see, even though he said, yeah, I get it, he couldn't wrap his mind around how watching a football game could be a spiritual activity. But see, for Christians, everything we do is spiritual. There is no secular spiritual separation. It's all done to the glory of God. And what I hope to do over the next 5 lectures is wrap your head around that statement. Because once you understand that, it will change everything you do. Now, when I was in college, actually when I graduated college, this is kind of what the secular spiritual divide looked like, right? You could be a pastor or a missionary. That was kind of a spiritual calling, vocation, right? Then you had all these lesser jobs that were basically secular, quote unquote, right? Now, I speak at a lot of colleges now, and one of the things I do, and I was told you guys are a real smart crowd, so I didn't try this on you, but one of the things I do when I go into college is I say this. I say, think about what you did yesterday. What percentage of it was secular, and what percent was spiritual? Write it down on a piece of paper. And then I go around and ask people what they wrote. And this is in Christian colleges, and I've done this 20 times, I bet, over the last 4 or 5 years. I've never had anyone say 100% spiritual. But that's the right answer, right? Highest I ever got, one young lady said, I'll give myself 80% spiritual yesterday because I did my Bible study in the dorm last night, right? See? Everybody's stuck in this spiritual secular divide. Here's the interesting thing. If you study the Hebrew language, and I'm not a good language student, but I have studied it some, there's not a word in this context, there's not a word for spiritual in the Hebrew language. Why is that? Were the ancient Hebrews not spiritual people? No. They saw everything as spiritual. They didn't need a word to separate out spiritual from secular. That wasn't even in their thinking, and it should not be in ours today. Now, here's the interesting thing. If you go to college campuses today, here's what the secular-spiritual divide looks like. It has changed a little bit. If I can get my computer to change here. Right? Look what's missing. You know, pastor and missionaries aren't on there anymore. But now there's this whole slew of change-the-world jobs. Everybody wants to go into international development. I may be stepping on some toes because some of you guys may want to do this. They want to go to international development. They want to be an inner-city teacher or human rights lawyer or social entrepreneur because these are the cool, kind of change-the-world jobs. And somehow or another, people see those as being very spiritual, right? But on the other side of the ledger are stuff like this: to be a teacher in a suburban school someplace, to be an engineer. What a snoozer, right? To be a store clerk, right? To be a corporate lawyer. Oh, my gosh, that's just the pits, right? The worst. Small business owner. And really, at the bottom of the list, one thing you absolutely do not, this is right on the border of sin itself, is to be in politics, right? What I'm trying to tell you today is all those things, everything on that list, are things God is calling people to do today. And most of you will be called to do some of those things. And there's nothing wrong with the change the world jobs. God's calling people to do those too. But he's also calling people to do the other ones. And one is not more important than the other. That's the most important thing. Now, as I said, this is a thing that's really happened in the last, I guess, 100 years. Because if you go back over 100 years, you heard preachers preach all the time about the danger of the secular spiritual divide. You never hear it in a sermon today, right? Let me give you a quote from one of my favorite preachers. This is a guy who preached back in the late 1800s. His name, you may have read some of his stuff. His name is Charles Spurgeon, probably one of my favorite preachers. This is from a sermon he did called All for Jesus in 1874. He said this: to a man who lives under God, nothing is secular. Everything is sacred. He must put on his workday garment. It's a vestment to him. He sits down at his meal, and it's a sacrament. He goes forth to his labor, and therein exercises the office of the priesthood. His breath is incense. His life a sacrifice. He sleeps on the bosom of God and lives and moves in his divine presence. To draw a hard and fast line and say, this is secular and this is spiritual, is, to my mind, diametrically opposed to the teaching of Christ and to the spirit of the gospel. You won't hear that in most churches today, but you need to. So I'm here to tell it to you. Right? So I want you to hold this in the back of your mind, because everything I say for the next 5 lectures is going to be couched around this idea about, for Christians, there is no such thing as secular. Everything is spiritual. You know, it's interesting, because if you talk to people about this, they will tell you, well, you know, it's not like secular is bad stuff. It's just stuff that God's not interested in. But I'm here to tell you, God is interested in everything. Abraham Kuyper, one of his most famous quotes, he said, every square inch of this universe, Jesus says, is mine. Right? I'm paraphrasing there. So, let's move on. Let's see if I can run these two computers. One of the things that this long way of thinking, it leads us to say things like this. I used to say this all the time, right? Did you hear about John? He's putting his job at the bank or whatever to go into full-time Christian service. What did that mean? It meant that he was going to be a pastor or a missionary or be in some kind of full-time ministry type job, right? Maybe lead worship at a church or run a camp, Christian camp or something like that, right? So we have to really divest ourselves from that way of thinking. Here's what the Apostle Paul tells us. He tells us in Corinthians, he says this: whether you eat or drink, whatever you do, do it to the glory of God. Whatever you do. We don't think of eating and drinking as being a spiritual thing, but it is. Watching TV, watching a football game, those are spiritual endeavors, and we need to see them that way. And certainly all the work you do. Now, What I tell a lot of college students, I say, you know, I'm going to talk a lot about vocational calling. And you may say, well, Hugh, I don't have a vocation yet. Yes, you do. Most of you, I would almost say all of you, have a vocational calling. Your vocational calling right now is to be a student. That's what God's called you to do. So you want to understand that every time you study, regardless what it is, that's a spiritual activity. Every time you take a test, every time you listen to a lecture, you're engaging in spiritual activity, and you should recognize it as such. Now, a great book that you should read sometime is a book called The Call, and it was written by Oz Guinness almost 20 years ago now. And he says in it something very interesting. He basically says that our primary calling as Christians is a calling that we all share. And that calling is the calling to become a disciple of Christ. That's our primary calling. And that's a call to be. But then he goes on and says this, and this is very interesting, I think, very insightful, and helps us understand more about how we apply this idea of everything spiritual to all work that we do in our lives. He says this. He says, yes, our primary calling is to be a disciple of Christ, but out of that primary calling flow four secondary callings. Our call to the family, our call to church, our call to community, and our call to vocation. And really, when you think about it, these are calls to do. This is where the rubber meets the road. This is where we work out our salvation in fear and trembling. It's by doing the work in these four buckets, right? Now, here's an interesting thing. As you go through different seasons of your life, the time you spend in these four areas is going to change. It's going to expand. It's going to contract. For example, as you go off to college, you're not going to have a whole lot of family time. You may go home and see your parents and family. You may be on Christmas or Thanksgiving or in the summer. But that time is fairly short, right? But later, when you move on in life a little bit, you get married, there's going to be a little more family time because you're going to spend more time with your wife or husband. When you start having your kids, more family time, right? And then guess what's going to happen? Your kids are going to grow up and they're going to go off to college. And then your family time shrinks. And then if you're fortunate enough, like we are, you'll eventually your kids will have kids and you'll have grandkids. Then your family time expands again. Well, there's only 24 hours in a day, and as that contracts and expands, one of these others is going to have to contract and expand. So the amount of time you spend in these four areas is constantly changing, but all four areas are absolutely critically important. See, we're all called to bring our gifts and our talents to the church for the edification of the body of Christ. So when we're the church gathered, right, on Sunday or Wednesday night, we help using our gifts to edify the body, to build up the body of Christ, so that when we're the church scattered on Monday through Friday, when we're out being salt and light, we can be better at what God's called us to be. So we all have a calling to that. It's just not, you just don't go and sit. You have a role to play in your church, and you need to find out what that is. We're all called to serve in our families, right? To bring flourishing to our families, to do things that increases the amount of flourishing that exists in our families. You know, our roles in our families change. We're a son or a daughter. Later we may be a husband or a wife. Or now I've moved into the role of grandfather. Great role, right? But those roles are going to change. You might be a brother or sister, but you have an important role to play. God has a calling for you to do there, to do certain things there. You have a call to your community. This is really exemplified by the parable of the Good Samaritan, right? We're to be salt and light in our communities. We're to do things to help engage our people in our communities. Not only to share the gospel, certainly that's true, but to serve the common good as well. Right? One of the things the Bible makes it very clear is that we should be on guard against poverty. We should be doing things to push back poverty. And I'll talk about that more in another lecture. And last is our vocational call. Now, these first three calls, typically you don't get paid to do, right? This last one is typically something you're going to get paid to do, but that's not always true. For example, probably no one's paying you to be a student, but it still is a vocational calling. So what I would suggest is the work we do, all the work, all four of these areas, is what the Bible calls stewardship. And we'll talk about this more in detail later. I want to introduce you, if you've never heard or read anything from this woman, there's a woman named Dorothy Sayers. Anybody heard Dorothy Sayers? Good, a lot of people have. I want to give you a quote from her that really kind of sums up what we've been talking about so far. Dorothy's supposed to be talking, but I don't... Is the sound on?
The secular vocation.
Okay, let me start, Dorothy.
She has allowed work and religion to become
secular. It's interesting to bring a voice back from 70 years ago.
And nothing has the church so lost her hold on reality as in her failure to understand and respect the secular vocation. She has allowed work and religion to become separate departments, and is astonished to find that, as a result, the secular work of the world is turned to purely selfish and destructive ends, and that the greater part of the world's intelligent workers have become irreligious, or at least uninterested in religion. But is this astonishing? How can anyone remain uninterested in a religion which seems to have no concern with 9/10 of his life?
Now, Dorothy Sayers wrote this probably over 75, 80 years ago. And really, what was happening then is the church was just starting to go away from this idea of the integration of faith and work, that all of our work was important. It was just starting to move away from that, probably beginning of the First World War. And she wrote this shortly after that. And she spoke several times about this. She's written an incredible essay called on work that if you take a look at it, it's in a book called... Crisis, something in crisis, but you can find it. If you Google her and type in faith and work, it's an essay well worth reading. So what do we want to do? What do I want to try to communicate to you? Obviously, I want to talk about, you know, just destroying this idea of the secular spiritual divide in your own minds, that you don't fall into that trap. But I also want to talk to you about the importance of our work and how God has called us specifically to do work that glorifies Him, that serves the common good, and furthers His kingdom in this time and in this place. And that's critically important. The Bible talks about a lot, and we'll look at a number of passages. Here's one of the things I really want to do in our time together over the next couple of days. I want to have a paradigm shift in the way that you think about faith and work. Everyone knows this logo, probably the most popular logo in the world, right? But a lot of people don't know the story behind this logo. Fred Smith, who still owns Federal Express, about 20 years ago went to his advertising people and said, look, I want you to make me a logo that'll last for the next 20 years. I want it to be one of the most well-known logos in the world. I want it to be clear, bold, and I want it to really be something that stands out. They said, okay, we can do that. He said, one more thing. See, back 20, 30 years ago, if you had a freight company, it was traditional for you to have an arrow in your logo. And Smith says, I don't want to move away from tradition, so I want you to put an arrow in my logo, but I don't want it to be real obvious. Do you see the arrow in the FedEx logo? Some of you are nodding your head. If you're like me, I never get these puzzles. I can look at these things for an hour, and I never get it. So let me give you a hint, okay? Now do you see the arrow in the FedEx logo? Yeah. There are a few people out there like me. I get it. Hey, listen, I get that. I get that, right? Now, let me tell you something. You guys have seen that logo hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times and never seen the arrow. You will never look at it again without seeing the arrow. Absolutely. It will jump out every single time you look at it. What just happened here? You've had a paradigm shift in the way you look at this logo. What I want to do with you over the next four more lectures, because we're almost done with this one, for the next four lectures, is I want to give you the information and illustrations, and I want to put it back to the scriptures, and I want you to have a paradigm shift about the way that you look at work. And if you do that, not only are you going to find great significance in everything you do, but you will begin to find what God wants you to do for your calling. We'll talk specifically about this idea of calling in a later lecture. But it's the only way, understand, it's the only way you will ever find fulfillment. It's the only way you will find significance in the work that you do. See, one of the problems with the generations ahead of you, the millennials, and they don't like to be called that, but since we're not here today, I'll probably get away calling them that, is that they've come into the workforce, even Christian millennials, and I get to speak to a lot of Christian millennials, with preconceived notions about work. But one of the biggest problems is they suffer from this secular spiritual divide. And what happens is they go to work, and they get into the workplace, and they think that they're going to be running the company within a couple of years, and they have these great expectations because they've been lied to, and I'm going to talk about that in a later lecture. And what happens is they get very discouraged. One of the things I hope that we'll be able to accomplish, and really by having this shift, this mindset shift, one of the things that you'll be able to accomplish is you won't fall into that trap. You won't get discouraged when you get out and start working because you'll have a whole different set of expectations. Interesting enough, they have a word even. They call it the early life crisis, right? At 24 and already they're having a midlife crisis around their work. And what typically happens, even Christian millennials, they get so discouraged with their work because it's not what they thought it was going to be, that they go look for significance in something else in their life, whether it be a hobby or a relationship or other sort of things. The problem is, and this is a huge problem, the problem is that God gave us work for specific reasons. If you go to Genesis 2:15, it says, God put Adam in the garden to work it and to take care of it. We were made to work. Listen, I used to live in South Florida. I would see people retire and come down and play golf all their life. Guess what happened to them? They all died. Right? You're not made to play golf all your life unless you've been called to be a professional golfer. And unfortunately, God didn't give me that calling. I would have loved it, but there are a few people who have been called to play golf all that, but there are very few, right? You see, one of the problems that we have bought so much into the culture, there's nothing about retirement in the scriptures. Retirement is something we've just made up, and yet most Christians today have fallen into it because they don't see the work that they do every day as something God intended for them to do from the very beginning. And they want to get done with it as quick as they can and they go do nothing for the rest of their lives. That doesn't work very well because we weren't made to do that. We were made to work. Now, there may be a time in your life when you get older that you don't have to work for money anymore and you can go do other things. That's okay. I mean, if retirement means moving out of one job into something else where you have more flexibility, that's fine. But God has never called us to stop working, right? And that's something we need to know. So one of the things I talk about in this little book, How Then Should We Work, is that the number one tool that God has given each one of us to find personal satisfaction and significance, to further God's kingdom in this place and in this time, and to serve our neighbor is simply our work. And if you haven't heard that before, you're going to hear it a bunch more times in the next several lectures. So I want to close with a video that kind of wraps some of these themes that we've done at the Institute for Faith, Work, and Economics. And I started about 7 years ago, I started the Institute for Faith, Work, and Economics because I really believe that even though there's kind of a fledgling faith and work movement out there, and there's lots of books being written about faith and work, I thought that there were some missing pieces that we could bring to the table. And over the last 5 or 6 years we've done this. This is actually the first book we've published. And it really kind of talks about my journey, what I had to discover to understand how to integrate my faith and my work the way God wanted me to, right? It's really about me having that paradigm shift that didn't take place in 5 lectures. It took me 10 years to figure it out. So I'm basically going to give you, in 5 lectures, what I learned over 10 years. So hopefully that'll help. So let me play this video and then we'll have a couple minutes for some Q&A.
Our lives are not divided into for us, for the good of all He has created.
We're good, thank you. We've got a couple minutes. Questions? Anybody's got any questions? If you stand up, maybe I can hear you. You want a longer break. I know what the deal is, right? You listen to two lectures, you say, oh, we don't have a break. We want a longer break. Anything? Going once, going twice. Yes, ma'am. Yeah. Yeah, good question, good question. Interesting enough, if you look up the Hebrew word for worship, that's typically used in the Hebrew. It's the same Hebrew word that's used for work. And there are a lot of people that suggest that, you know, they're synonymous, that part of our worship to God is doing our work well. And that's another way of looking at how we should work, right? So let's take something you guys were doing. Sitting in a lecture, right? See, we have this idea, we have a very limited idea of worship. Right, worship is much more expansive in the Old Testament, particularly, than we consider. We consider worship a specific time where you have a group, and typically you sing a little bit, you pray a little bit, someone gives a sermon, and that's worship, right? But worship is really about your relationship and the way you're thinking about God, right? And worship could take place anywhere. It can take place when you're on a beach looking at a gorgeous sunrise. It can take place when you're working. All of a sudden have a breakthrough and think, man, this is great. This is, it all worked out, right? But what we really need to see beyond that is worship takes place anytime when we're really doing what it is God has called us to do consciously, right? That's worship. When we're being faithful to God's call in our life. So when you're sitting here in a lecture, this doesn't seem like worship, right? But it is. Right? We have to broaden what we think about worship because all of our work is worship. It's very interesting that we look at it that way. One of the things that the prophets talk a lot about when they talk about the new heaven and the new earth, where we're going to end up, we will have work in the new heaven and new earth. Isaiah makes it very clear in some of his prophecies as he's talking about this place, it's going to be a physical place where we'll have physical bodies, we'll have resurrection bodies. We're not really sure exactly what those are going to be like, but we'll have them, right? And we'll be doing physical work. And we'll understand, because it'll be a world without sin, and we'll clearly understand the connection between work and worship. I tell people this. Think about something you did in work. Maybe you're taking a test, right? And you knew every answer, and it was just clicking, and you were just right on, and you thought, man, this is easy, right? It's hard, but it's easy, right? Well, that 10 seconds, or it didn't happen to me very much in school, but if it happens to you, it may be 5 seconds for me, right? But that 10 seconds is going to give you a glimpse of what work is going to be like in the new heaven and new earth. Because we'll work there for eternity. And it'll be easy, and it'll be incredible, and it'll be so fulfilling, you cannot possibly imagine. But here's the thing. God wants to give you a glimpse of that today and the work that you do now. And you let Him do that by, one, understanding that all work is worship, by having a different way of looking at it, that all the work you do, whether any of those categories, is done to the glory of God, to serve the common good, to further His kingdom. Yeah, good question. Real good question. Another question. Yes, sir. Okay, so am I technically? Yeah.
I knew technically that everything in my life.
Okay. Yep.
Right.
Yep.
But somehow it still
was fine. Yep. Yeah, good for you. Yeah, no, that's good. The problem is the culture around us doesn't get it. The Christian culture around us doesn't get it. So it's hard when it's hard to work that way when you're not being affirmed all the time, right? and you're not, it's not, you're not being reminded of it. One of the things we do at the Institute of Faith, Work, and Economics, we work with a lot of business people. I was a business guy, I speak to a lot of business guys, and we talk to them about exactly what you're saying, because they'll say, I know this intellectually, but I get so caught up in my work every day, I forget it until I get home, right? And I'll think about it and go, oh, that's right, you know, because we get so swept up in what we're doing, and we're so influenced by the culture around us, and even the Christian culture, right, is not very helpful. One of the things we do at the Institute, we do a blog that we send out every morning at 6 o'clock, and people read that every morning just to remind them. You know, it's really short, it's like 700 to 800 words, but it's about something around the emphasis of faith and work and how they're combined, right? And so we do that intentionally just to remind people about it so that they think about it. I know people have things, you know, verses, you know, that verse I read out of Corinthians, have that on, you know, on their desk or something where they can see it to constantly remind them. Because if we're not reminded, the culture is so much the other way that it's so easy to get swept back into that. And that's the struggle, right? Is to constantly remind us that work is worship, that work is what we're called to do, and that it's good, and that's rewarding, and it's all these positive things, because you're going to hear for the next 40, 50 years how bad work is. And I have to admit, work is hard, right? And work is not hard because that's the way God intended it to be. Work is hard because of the curse, because of man's sin. You know, I'll come home sometimes and tell my wife, man, I struggled under the curse today, right? But that doesn't mean work is not good. It's hard right now because of Adam's sin and because of our sin, because we live in a sinful world. And that's why it's so important to look for those little times when God gives you a glimpse of the way that it's supposed to be. And those are things that you hold on, knowing that that's the way it's going to be in the future. That this period of time now is really short compared with the eternity that we'll live with Him. So, it's definitely a mind shift, and I'm telling you, it's not easy. It takes some work. So, that's a good question. One more question, or a couple more questions. Yes?
Is there anything else specifically that you say to
the college students that is just so overwhelmed with 19 credits
that
they
have to get through the next
semester? That's right. Yeah, no, absolutely. Very good question. And I get that question all the time. And one of the things I did, I was running computer companies, came up to the Washington, D.C. area, which is where we're now, and was with some guys who bought a computer company, sold it. And then I spent 7 years running a seminary, believe it or not. I was executive director for Reformed Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C. And I would see students at seminary come all the time. And they would just, you know, they were trying to work, and they were trying to do something in their church, and they were trying to study, and it was just like, I gotta get through this. And they hated it. They weren't enjoying it. I'm thinking, you're studying God's Word. I mean, where's the joy in this? And they said, I don't have time for it, right? Because they had a future mentality. They felt like, if I can get through this and get my seminary degree and become a pastor, then God can really use me. Let me tell you, that smells of smoke and it's from the pit. Don't believe that. God cannot use you any more tomorrow than He can right now. And so you've got to grab hold of that and really take that as the truth and as your own truth. And understand, yes, He's equipping you through your schoolwork to do the next thing that He wants you to do, and it's important. But live in the here and now. Understand that what you're doing today, because see, in their minds, they thought, you know, I'll be able to be really the man of God when I get that seminary degree. That's not true. You know, you're not going to be any more than that of God then than you are right now. You know, and they think, well, I'll be able to share the gospel better. No, you can't, right? The Holy Spirit's in you now. It's going to be in you then. One of the problems with most people in our society is they either live in the past or they live in the future. And both of those are very, very destructive. Now, fortunately, or unfortunately, you're young enough that you don't have much of a past. But you get to my age, I know a lot of people think, oh, the good old days. You know, there weren't any good old days. You know, it's always been hard. And they look through this kind of rose-colored glasses, and they long for things to be like it was. It's crazy. I lived in the good old days. They weren't good old days. It was hard, right? Then another group is just like this man in seminary. You know, man in seminary, they're looking to the future. If I can just get to this, or if I can just get to that, I'll be happy, or I'll be God's great man or woman when I just get that done. That's a lie as well. Right? We have to be able to live learning from events that happened to us in the past, learning what God wants us to learn, living in a current state, you know, in our current lives, right? Be fully here, being fully present, being fully ready to listen to God's Holy Spirit to do whatever He wants us to do. But at the same time, preparing for whatever it is He's got next for us. So that there has to be a proper balance there. But I see far too many people that are so worried about, I've got to get these grades so I can get into this great school, so I can do this, I can do that, I can do that. And what happens, this is what happens with maybe some of your older brothers and sisters, when they finally get done with their college and they get into the work world, they're disappointed because it's all been getting ready for this great moment, and they get the great moment, and it's not what they thought it was going to be. Don't fall into that trap. That's a terrible trap. Live your life fully today. Ask God, what do you want me to do today? What's the work that you want me to do? How do you want me to influence and be salt and light to the people around me, even in this conference, right? And He'll tell you. And then go do it. And if you can live your life that way, it's incredibly fulfilling. But most people miss that opportunity. Very good question. Very good one. One more question, then we'll call it. Yes, sir. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. It's kind of a good news, bad news thing. You know, if you go back 200 years ago, everybody did apprenticeships, but then whatever you apprentice, that's what you're going to do for the rest of your life. There wasn't really the flexibility like we have in our current culture to be able to change jobs and learn new things. And see, I think that's great. I've worked in the business world for 30 years, and I worked in actually five different, completely different industries, which is, you know, 100 years ago would have been unheard of. But it was a lot of fun for me because I like new things, I like to learn things. Some people like to work the same thing their whole life, and that's fine too. But the great thing about our world today and our economy today have the flexibility to do that. And I think that's good. That being said, I think what is comparable to apprenticeship in today's world is internships, right? And they're not quite as structured as the old apprenticeships were, but they're very, very helpful. And I would strongly urge you to find places during the summer or maybe you take a year off between high school and college even, do an apprenticeship or do an apprenticeship afterwards or while you're in college. Because here's the problem. You don't know what you don't know. And one of the things that most of you don't know is what you're good at. See, everybody comes out of college thinking, I've got to get the perfect job right out of college. Well, first of all, there's no perfect job. Second, right, you don't know anything when you come out of college, right? I had a couple of my best friends became attorneys. And, you know, they studied and, you know, and really worked a lot. And later they told me, you know, I didn't learn how to practice law until after I got out of law school and got a job. That's when I really learned how to practice law. They didn't teach me anything, right? So one of the things I would encourage you to do is early on, do some internships, get exposed to as many things as you possibly can, and put yourself in a position where you can begin to learn what you're good at. You'll be surprised. We do a post-college 9-month program, leadership program called the Fellows Institute. And it's done in different churches, about 30 churches around the nation that do these. And it's really about faith and work. So kids come out of college, go, they actually live with families in the churches. You have a 3-day internship that you do in something that you're interested in the business world or whatever thing you've studied for. You work in the church. Typically, they work with youth groups or whatever. You take seminary level classes around faith and work. And it's really a 9-month study program to think through, what is it God wants me to do, right? And the kids that come out of that are just, I mean, they're just radically changed because they really get it, because they thought about it within community. Because typically there's 10 to 15 kids. So they come together and meet every day or a couple times a week in community. But they're also in the community of the larger church. And they're also in the community of the larger community. So it's really an incredible experience to help them think through, what is it God wants me to do? And in that, they're getting exposed to a lot of different things. And so that's one of the things I think is so important. I mean, if you get opportunities to intern or even a summer job, you know, don't do the same job every summer. Go do different things. You know, I cut lawns one summer. I worked for a surveying team one summer. You know, those things are great. I mean, I quickly learned I didn't want to be a surveyor, but we've got about 10 acres in Northern Virginia, and I built a house on it a couple years ago. And my wife and I wanted to have an apple orchard, right? So, I mean, this is kind of crazy, but I went and got a surveyor's instrument to lay out where I wanted the trees. And my wife says, you don't need to be this precise. And I'm not a very precise person. She thought it was really bizarre. But then, you know, a year later, after the trees had grown up a little bit, I pulled up a Google picture of our property, right? And it had been fairly recent, and you could see the trees. And every line was perfectly straight in the orchard. So, yeah, that's why I did this. I don't want people to look see crooked row of trees, right? But I could do that because I worked for a surveyor one summer, and I knew how to use the instruments. Because what you'll find in internships, you'll find a lot more of what you're not good at than what you're good at. But that's very important to learn. So, I would take advantage of those if you can. And once again, I think this kind of, you allude to this in the question, I'm not sure college is for everybody. You know, we've been sold this bill of goods that everybody should go to college. I'm not sure that's true. I know guys in the IT world that didn't go to college, went straight into IT, and I trained a bunch of them, right? They're making more money today than any of their friends did that went to college. That being said, I believe that if God's given you the chops to really do well in college, you probably need to be thinking about advanced degrees. We need just as many Christians with PhDs and that have come out of the great schools, the big schools. We need to be playing in that space. So if God's given you the ability to do that, I'm sure there's some kids here today that young people here today that could go do that. You should be looking at that. Don't turn your back on it. The trick, and we're going to talk more about this later, and this is a good place to stop, is that what you really want to do at this point in your life is being open to as many experiences as you can around work and begin to understand what it is you're good at. Because understanding what you're good at, what you're passionate about, will begin to give you a sense of what God is calling you to do for the rest of your life. We'll end it there, and we'll pick that up in the next lecture. Okay? Thank you again.